to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Confessions of Inigo Philbrick by Mark Seal. Episode 4, The Law. The FBI art crime team are the high sheriffs of the art market. The Philbrick case, with at least 24 alleged victims across the world, was an insanely complicated puzzle that took months to understand, much less solve, according to Special Agents Christopher McKeough and Jessica Dittmer. Foremost among the injured parties was the art investment firm Fine Art Partners. From their base in Berlin, the principals in the firm traveled to London, where Philbrick proved his prowess with a dazzling first sale. A work by the visual artist Don Vo in 2014, which he resold at a respectable profit before they'd even sent our share of the purchase price, an FAP principal would write in his victim impact statement. After Philbrick's downfall, the principal would say he learned the resale never happened. Philbrick had paid their alleged profit share out of other funds. "We took the bait," he wrote. Between 2014 and 2019, FAP invested $17.8 million with Philbrick. In February 2016, prosecutors say, they agreed to purchase Rudolf Stingel's untitled Picasso through Philbrick for $7.1 million. 3 heat-generating years later, Philbrick told FAP that he had consigned the Stingel on their behalf to Christie's, which had guaranteed a price of $9 million, meaning if the auction price was less, Christie's would buy it for the agreed amount. Meanwhile, in June 2017, Philbrick had done a separate deal involving the same Stingel and 2 other paintings with Simon and David Rubin, 2 of the richest people in the UK. Represented by Simon's daughter, art consultant Lisa Rubin, their company, Guzzini Properties, paid $6 million for the paintings. In all, prosecutors say, Philbrick sold interest in the Stingel to 3 different parties, who gave him more than $15 million in total. Philbrick says he received less than $10 million total. When the Stingel sold in May 2019 for a disappointing $5.5 million, its listed consigner was Guzzini. That was news to Fine Art Partners, who began investigating. They eventually discovered that Philbrick was not in possession of the work, and that the Christie's contract Philbrick had sent them was forged. Pesco, on whose yacht Philbrick and Baker Harbor met, turned out to be another victim. In August 2016, according to a witness statement filed by Pesco, Philbrick propositioned him with Basquiat's stellar 1982 painting, Humidity, featuring a red-nosed figure who resembles Andy Warhol with his arms outstretched to the heavens. "If they moved fast," Pesco said Philbrick promised, "they could scoop it up at a 30% discount." Philbrick said Christie's would guarantee it for $35 million, which enticed Pesco's father's company, Sat Finance, to invest $12.2 million for 50% of the painting. Philbrick retained the other 50%, along with a $3 million loan from Sat Finance, secured by the painting. Philbrick produced a sales slip that showed he would be paying $18.4 million for the work from an entity called SKH Management Corp., according to Pesco, and later took him to see it in a Long Island storage facility. There was just one problem. SKH never owned the Basquiat, which had already been purchased by Philbrick from Phillips Auction House for only $12.5 million. 2 months later, according to prosecutors, Philbrick sold another 12.5% of Humidity to Delahunty Fine Art. Telling the gallerist Damian Delahunty he had purchased the painting from SKH for $22 million, omitting that he had sold an interest in the painting and transferred its title to Sat Finance. The Christie's auction did not materialize, Pesco would state, so the alleged guarantee never arrived. Not to worry, Philbrick told Pesco. He had several interested buyers, including the fashion designer Tory Burch and a Saudi royal, according to Pesco's statement. A representative for Burch says she knows nothing about this. Philbrick had also pledged the oversold and overleveraged Basquiat to a collateral pool for a $10 million loan from Athena Art Finance, a New York-based lender that secures loans with blue-chip art. Athena, Sat Finance, and Delahunty are currently locked in litigation over ownership of the Basquiat, according to the U.S. government's sentencing memo in Philbrick's case. Some of the two dozen victims the FBI identifies as being caught up in the scheme must have been left feeling as if they were trapped inside a Cubist painting, their prize purchases carved up and resold in myriad ways. In some instances, Philbrick purported to sell works owned by others without their knowledge or consent, says someone familiar with the case. In other cases, he purported to pledge as collateral on loans to his own business works owned by others without their permission, as he did with works by Basquiat, Stengel, Donald Judd, and Christopher Wool. Philbrick's dealings also ensnared his former mentor, Jay Jopling. By 2017, frustrated over unsold art he and Philbrick owned together, Jopling demanded an explanation. According to Newland, Philbrick told Jopling that a client was delaying payment for a $4.5 million sale. Philbrick then invented one from whole cloth. An Argentine financier named Martin Herrero, with a fake email address, correspondence, and payment plan to match. By December 2018, Philbrick was reportedly $20 million in debt and spinning plates, in the words of the FBI's McKeough. His accounts to me were more erratic and inconsistent, Pesco said in his witness statement. He was very nervous at a lunch we had together in London on 30 September 2019. He had two glasses of wine and was visibly shaking. Another client recalls a major red flag. You could see it in his Instagram pictures, he says. His eyes were hollow and dark. It wasn't the same bright-looking, vivacious Inigo. Around this time, Pesco called the art investor Andre Sakai. Sakai and Philbrick were so close that Sakai was the godfather to Philbrick's first daughter. Pesco had meanwhile developed a relationship over a smaller Basquiat with Sakai. Pesco believed he had bought the smaller Basquiat in November 2017 as a 50-50 partner with Philbrick. Sakai told Pesco he was an even partner with Philbrick in the same work. It became clear that Mr. Philbrick had told each of us that we were his partners in the painting, but that in fact we were partners with each other, Pesco wrote in his witness statement. We had both been lied to. Pesco confronted Philbrick in October 2019 in a series of messages and phone calls. He cried on the phone to me, confessed what he had done, and started to send me various documents, Pesco said in his statement. That same month, Fine Art Partners filed a lawsuit against Philbrick in Miami, alleging that Philbrick refused to return works of art, including untitled Picasso. FAP was soon in touch with the FBI. When investigators had assembled the puzzle, they found that this Philbrick matter is the largest art-based fraud scheme that we know of in U.S. history, says McKeough. Philbrick is the face of the operation, says the FBI's Dittmer. He was the one who was able to get clients to trust in him and to support and have him as a broker going to make those deals on their behalf. But Newland was the numbers guy and understood the money components of it. By 2019, Philbrick and Newland's tenuous business relationship had dissolved. During one of their last communications in early 2019, Philbrick says, Newland told him he'd thrown his laptop into a body of water near his home. That was his way of telling me, you're on your own now, Philbrick says. Newland's attorney says this never happened. In October 2019, Philbrick's galleries in London and Miami were shuttered, their walls empty, FedEx and UPS stickers littering their doors. It looked like somebody had left in a hurry, with no forwarding address, says the Miami art advisor Karen Boyer of the spaces Philbrick had rented in the city's design district for what Philbrick would say was $30,000 a month. Philbrick himself had disappeared. Among the documents he left behind were spreadsheets showing the dizzying positions each investor owned in the various percentages of the oversold art, along with a handwritten note that read, according to the government's sentencing memorandum, how to F them. Philbrick says the note was in Newland's handwriting, but Newland's attorney Burlingame calls this claim false and ridiculous, adding, check the difference between his and Rob's sentences, 20 months for Newland versus 7 years for Philbrick. Rather than stuff his pockets and blow victims' money, Rob spent down his and his wife's life savings for the privilege of working for Philbrick and thereby ruining his life. Episode 5, The Escape. Are you okay? Baker Harbor asked Philbrick in the midst of a torrential thunderstorm in Miami, where they were temporarily residing. It was October 20th, 2019. Lightning crackled across the tropical skies as the couple waited for an Uber in a covered parking lot. They had just watched Joaquin Phoenix demonize Gotham City in Joker, and Philbrick seemed in a fragile state, says Baker Harbor. Philbrick by then knew of at least one lawsuit against him, and his lawyer had advised him that I no longer had a seat at the table, and this was a matter for the lawyers. If I had to go somewhere for a while, would you come with me? He asked her. The next morning, she woke to a suitcase slamming to the floor in their sunny condominium. Where are we going? She asked. I don't know, said Philbrick. She suggested visiting her grandmother in Australia. Within hours, they were on a Qantas flight, cattle class, says Baker Harbor. During a layover at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, Philbrick withdrew his last $400 at an ATM. Landing in Sydney, they were told that brush fires ruled out a flight to her grandmother's rural home in New South Wales. They tried her late grandfather's birthplace in Fiji, but couldn't get a flight that day. McKeo says, we have no information that Victoria was aware of the fraud scheme. Why don't we go to Vanuatu? She asked Philbrick. My mother has friends there. After more than a month of travel, with stops in Japan, Australia, and New Caledonia, they made a temporary home in Vanuatu, a small archipelago nation in the southwestern Pacific, whose borders quickly shut down due to COVID, says Baker Harbor. Many would later point out that Vanuatu has no extradition treaty with the U.S. It became a respite for Philbrick. From the art world, from attorneys, and from a cesspool of debt. For months, the couple reveled in the village-like environment, Baker Harbor says, enjoying the fresh fruit, the pho in the workers' cafes, the sun-kissed beaches. Philbrick even got a government-issued Vanuatu driver's license, using his full name. 6 months after their arrival, Baker Harbor was pregnant. I was traveling on my U.S. passport, hardly a fugitive, insists Philbrick. The Justice Department which considered him one in April 2020, disagrees. Back home, burned collectors were seething. Attorney Judd Grossman, who represents several of Philbrick's former clients, offers a representative opinion when he calls Philbrick greedy. He did this to benefit himself, to live the lifestyle that he saw so many of his clients living. But when things didn't go his way, rather than face the music, he ran, and he left all of them holding the bag. In a December 2019 ArtNet column, Philbrick's former friend, client, and hard burgundy drinking buddy Kenny Schachter called Philbrick's disappearance the art world's equivalent of Where's Waldo. Schachter designed a wanted poster of Philbrick, $10,000 reward, and published excerpts of Instagram messages he received from someone calling themselves at Steve_Irwin_Pitts. The Aussie naturalist speared to death by one of the stingrays he cared about so deeply. Get it? Schachter's inference was clear. The sender was Philbrick, on the lam from the collectors he felt he had so capably served. Nobody was stiffed. It was just a few bad deals, wrote at Steve_Irwin_Pitts. Things will be made good. Philbrick says he never sent these messages. The story went viral, at least in the art world. Determined to tell their story their way, Philbrick and Baker Harbor helped produce a TV docuseries treatment which ramped up the drama of their disappearance. It's one of the most jaw-dropping art world stories of recent years, the producers would later say, culminating in a love story that spanned multiple countries, multi-million-dollar art deals, and an international manhunt ending in an exotic South Pacific archipelago. On the afternoon of June 12, 2020, the long arm of the law reached from across the ocean. It was 3 p.m., and Philbrick and Baker Harbor were in the local market, searching for what they'd heard was an amazing green tea taro cake. Walking through a series of what he calls tin-roofed breeze block shops, they reached their destination, where the taro cake awaited. But then, an eerie silence. Parting the crowd of peaceful islanders was a team, Philbrick recalls, of burly giants in flak jackets. Baker Harbor, 5.5 months pregnant, watched her fiancé's face turn white like he'd been tasered. Then one of the giants spoke. Are you Inigo Philbrick? And it's almost like watching an animal being electrocuted, she says. They hustled Philbrick into a red Ford, handcuffs biting my wrist, five of us in the car, squeezed between two sweaty giants in the back, their Kevlar panels bowing out of their vest and digging into my sides. Where are they taking him? Baker Harbor thought, trailing behind in a car between two municipal police officers who had taken her phones. The car carrying Philbrick sped past the local prison and then the courthouse, and there was only one place left, Port Vila International Airport. They parked on the tarmac, and there, on what Philbrick calls an island that looked like it could be the set of Jurassic Park, waited a Gulfstream V. And I'm thinking, there's something wrong with his visa, recalls Baker Harbor. But she was unable to get answers, because these men were holding me down. Get the F off of me, she shouted, once the plane was airborne, leaping out of the car and clawing at the fence, screaming, where are you taking him? She collapsed onto the sidewalk, where the officers returned her phones, then drove her home. I memorized the tail number, she says. Soon she tracked down the plane's flight plan, Guam, and its registered owner. A Russian chess player, she says, and remembers thinking, he's been abducted by Russians. What the F has he done? She found a phone number, and what the chess player told her was both a relief and a terror. I lease my plane to the U.S. government. Wanted, U.S. national deported, read the headline in the Vanuatu Daily Post, over a photograph of Philbrick in beachwear, between two officers escorting him toward the giant jet. He'd been charged with wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. They made the independent decision to expel Mr. Philbrick from the island. He was not extradited, McKeough says of Vanuatu officials. Philbrick landed in Guam, home of the nearest FBI office, in a bathing suit and polo shirt. I was wearing Castanier espadrilles and shoved into a cell with Billy, a guy doing intermittent detention, Philbrick says of his tumultuous entry into the U.S. prison system, where he spent the next 3.5 years. In November 2021, having not seen daylight for almost 2 years, according to his fiancée, Philbrick entered a federal courthouse in Manhattan. His best-dressed list suits now traded for dingy brown prison garb, his fabulous crown of curly locks grown long and unkempt, his facial hair overgrown, his stylish silhouette shrunken from a prison diet of peanut butter sandwiches and lunch meat. Mr. Philbrick, let me ask you this, asked Judge Sidney H. Stein. Why did you do this? For money, Your Honor, Philbrick replied, his ever-so-proper accent muffled by his N95 COVID mask, adding, I was trying to find business and needed money for that. How do you plead, sir? Guilty, Your Honor. If only the Maid and Chelsea cameras had been around to catch these extraordinary events, reported the Daily Mail of the drama of Philbrick's arrest and court appearance. Instead, by the time the E4 reality TV show returned for its 23rd series last month, Victoria had slipped effortlessly back into her glamorous London life with a daughter, Gaia Grace, in tow. Where's Gaia's dad, a fellow cast member, asked Baker Harbor, who is clad in a glam red furry vest on the show. He's incarcerated right now, like awaiting sentencing, she responds. It's financial, white-collar stuff, but unfortunately he is being held in a place which is like maximum security. I've only seen him once since all of this has happened, and he was shackled. He looked good in his prison uniform, Baker Harbor adds, although orange is not really his color. Episode 6, The Comeback. You're like the talented Mr. Ripley, Schachter, who claims to have lost $1.75 million to his former friend, reportedly texted Philbrick when he was at large. He wrote back, Google how the movie ended. So Mr. Schachter did, wrote New York Times reporter Jacob Bernstein. It turns out Ripley strangles the person who may be about to expose him. Philbrick says he was not in contact with Schachter. Philbrick, however, seems poised for a rebirth, both on the screen. First, the multi-part Blue Ant Productions documentary with the working title The Real Inigo Philbrick Story, a tale of fortune, fame, and fraud, expected to air on the BBC in the summer and in real life. I'm 36, still a young man, and a second act is going to require my having been upfront and sincere, but also not a martyr, he says. My name is soiled, but I own it again, he continues, claiming that when various documents come to light, it might change the perception of his culpability. Of course I did things the wrong way, says Philbrick, but creatively and with the best of intentions. I'll have to tick the box for the felony. But I believe the art world is sophisticated enough to understand that I wasn't Bernie Madoff, who never made an actual investment. That may be decidedly wishful thinking. One client called his losses to Philbrick the worst nightmare of my life. Philbrick was charming and a good communicator, while in reality he was only a sleek liar trying to get closer to his victims. Philbrick was released from prison into home confinement and 2 years of supervised release in late January after being incarcerated for less than 4 years. He has a new wardrobe accessory, an electronic monitoring ankle bracelet, along with a sizable debt. $86,672,790 in restitution on which Philbrick says he'll begin making monthly payments following his release, which means he'll have to get back to work. And in the unregulated art world, there's no legal mechanism stopping him. Although his first priority is Baker Harbor and their 3-year-old daughter, Gaia, he oversees a professional future. "I'd like to get reestablished as an art dealer," he says, "and that's going to require a lot of listening and discussing with friends, clients, colleagues. I've had some indications of interest from friends in helping me get started, but it's too early to say more." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Bobby Brown, the beauty mogul on loyalty, lies, and a taxi driver named Marceau. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being at our beach house with my family in the Bahamas. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Queen Elizabeth II, small but mighty and deeply caring. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being anxious about the small stuff. On what occasion do you lie? Is that a handbag new? What do you consider your greatest achievement? Of course, my 3 boys, but also launching a new makeup company at 63. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Business school. Which living person do you most admire? My husband, who always seems to have everything in control and is so consistent. What is your greatest fear? Safety of loved ones. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Untruths, lies. When and where were you happiest? At each of my son's weddings. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My neck. What is your favorite journey? Jones Road. What is your greatest extravagance? Vacations. What is your greatest regret? I don't have any. Which word or phrase do you most overuse? That's so cool. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband, three sons, and granddaughter. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd love to be a great dancer. What is your current state of mind? Overwhelmed, but grateful. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be more chill. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? A taxi driver named Marceau, who is a character in a children's book written by my dad, Joe Brown. Marceau uses and teaches imagination to save the world. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? They'd all live closer. What is your most treasured possession? My photographs. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery, knowingly hurting others and having no remorse? Where would you like to live? Right where I live now, but I've always wanted to get a London flat. What is your favorite occupation? Entrepreneur. What is your most marked characteristic? Naivete. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty and liking to dance. Who are your favorite writers? Truman Capote and Linda Wells. Who are your heroes in real life? My parents, sister, and Aunt Alice. What are your favorite names? Dylan, Dakota, Duke. How would you like to die? I don't want to, but in my sleep, in a robe, at 120. What is your motto? I am me. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Bobby Brown. once more with feeling. For nearly 60 years, cabaret has transfixed and shocked audiences the world over. As Broadway welcomes a new revival starring Eddie Redmayne, Michael Rydell discusses the musical's enduring power with Liza Minnelli, Joel Grey, Sam Mendes, and other keepers of the flame. Opening photo, Liza Minnelli at the Weimar-era Kit Kat Club and Bob Fosse's film version of Cabaret, 1972. As director Rebecca Frecknell was rehearsing a new cast for her hit London revival of Cabaret, the actor playing Clifford Bradshaw, an American writer living in Berlin during the final days of the Weimar Republic, came on stage carrying that day's newspaper as a prop. It happened to be Metro, the free London tabloid commuters read on their way to work. The date was February 25th, 2022. When the actor said his line, "We've got to leave Berlin as soon as possible, tomorrow," Frecknell was caught short. She noticed the paper's headline, "Russia invades Ukraine." Cabaret, the groundbreaking 1966 Broadway musical that tackles fascism, anti-Semitism, abortion, World War II, and the events leading up to the Holocaust, had certainly captured the times once again. Back in rehearsals 4 months later, Frecknell and the cast got word that the Supreme Court had overturned Roe v. Wade. "Every time she checks up on Cabaret, it feels like something else has happened in the world," she told me over coffee in London last September. A month later, as Frecknell was preparing her production of Cabaret for its Broadway premiere, something else did happen. On October 7th, Hamas terrorists infiltrated Israel, killing at least 1,200 people and taking more than 240 hostages. The revival of Cabaret, starring Eddie Redmayne as the creepy yet seductive MC, Gail Rankin as the gin-swilling nightclub singer Sally Bowles, and Bibi Neuwirth as Fräulein Schneider. A Landlady Struggling to Scrape By opened April 21st at Manhattan's August Wilson Theater. It did so in the shadow of a pogrom not seen since the Einsatzgruppen slaughtered thousands of Jews in Eastern Europe, and in the shadow of a war between Israel and Hamas that continues months later with the killing of thousands of civilians in Gaza. Nearly 60 years after its debut, Cabaret still stings. That is its brilliance and its tragedy. Next photos, Babylon, Berlin. Cabaret movie poster, 1972. Joel Grey, the MC in the original Broadway musical, 1966. With Kit Kat Club dancers, 1972. Rehearsing with Jill Hayworth, playing Sally Bowles, 1966. Grey on stage, 1966. Minnelli on screen, 1972. Hayworth with director Hal Prince on opening night, 1966. Redmayne has been haunted by Cabaret ever since he played the MC in prep school. "I was staggered by the character," he says, "the lack of definition of it, the enigma of it." He played the part again during his first year at Cambridge at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where nearly 3,500 shoestring productions jostle for attention each summer. Cabaret, performed in a tiny venue that stank, Redmayne recalls, did well enough that the producers added an extra show. He was leering at the Kit Kat Club girls from 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., and then from 11 p.m. till 2 in the morning. "You'd wake up at midday. You barely see sunshine. I just became this gaunt, skeletal figure." His parents came to see him and said, "You need vitamin D." In 2021, Redmayne, by then an Oscar winner for The Theory of Everything and a Tony winner for Red, was playing the MC again, this time in Frecknell's West End production. His dressing room on opening night was full of flowers. There was one bouquet with a card he did not have a chance to open until intermission. It was from Joel Grey, who originated the role on Broadway and won an Oscar for his performance alongside Liza Minnelli in the 1972 movie. He welcomed the young actor to the family, Redmayne says. It was an extraordinary moment for me. Cabaret is based on Goodbye to Berlin, the British writer Christopher Isherwood's collection of stories and character studies set in Weimar Germany as the Nazis are clawing their way to power. Isherwood, who went to Berlin for one reason, boys, he wrote in his memoir, Christopher and His Kind, lived in a dingy boarding house amid an array of sleazy lodgers who inspired his characters. But aside from a fleeting mention of a host at a seedy nightclub, there is no MC in his vignettes. Nor is there an MC in I Am a Camera, John Van Druten's hit 1951 Broadway play, adapted from Isherwood's story Sally Bowles, from Goodbye to Berlin. The character, one of the most famous in Broadway history, was created by Harold Prince, who produced and directed the original Cabaret. People write about Cabaret all the time, says John Kander, who composed the show's music and is, at 96, the last living member of that creative team. They write about Liza. They write about Joel. And sometimes about us, Kander and lyricist Fred Ebb. None of that really matters. It's all Hal. Everything about this piece, even the variations that happen in different versions of it, is all because of Hal. Next, photos. Magic. Tragic. Gail Rankin was set to play Sally Bowles on Broadway in April. Alan Cumming, as the MC and cast, perform at the 2014 Tony Awards. Current MC Eddie Redmayne in the London production 2023. Jennifer Jason Leigh backstage as Bowles, 1998. The 2014 revival troupe. Stacey Sipowitz, Alan Cumming, Emma Stone, Benjamin Eakley, Andrea Goss, Kaylee Cronin. In 1964, Prince produced his biggest hit, Fiddler on the Roof. In the final scene, Tevye and his family, having survived a pogrom, leave for America. There is sadness, but also hope. And what of the Jews who did not leave? Cabaret would provide the tragic answer. But Prince was after something else. Without hitting the audience over the head, he wanted to create a musical that echoed what was happening in America. Young men being sent to their deaths in Vietnam. Racists, such as Alabama politician Bull Connor, sicking attack dogs on civil rights marchers. In rehearsals, Prince put up Will Count's iconic photograph of a white student screaming at a black student during the Little Rock crisis of 1957. "That's our show," he told the cast. A bold idea he had early on was to juxtapose the lives of Isherwood's lodgers with one of the tawdry nightclubs Isherwood had frequented. In 1951, while stationed as a soldier in Stuttgart, Germany, Prince himself had hung around such a place. Presiding over the third-rate acts was a master of ceremonies in white makeup and of indeterminate sexuality. "He unnerved me," Prince once told me, "but I never forgot him." Kander had seen the same kind of character at the opening of a Marlene Dietrich concert in Europe. An overpainted little man waddled out and said, "Willkommen, bienvenue," welcome, Kander recalls. The first song Kander and Ebb wrote for the show was called Willkommen. They wrote 60 more songs. Some of them were outrageous, Kander says. "We wrote some anti-Semitic songs, of which there were many in Weimar cabarets. Good Neighbor Cohen loaned you alone. We didn't get very far with that one." They did write one song about anti-Semitism, If You Could See Her, the Gorilla Song, in which the MC dances with his lover, a gorilla in a pink tutu. At the end of the number, he turns to the audience and whispers, "If you could see her through my eyes, she wouldn't look Jewish at all." It was, they thought, the most powerful song in the score. The working title of their musical was Welcome to Berlin, but then a woman who sold blocks of tickets to theater parties told Prince that her Jewish clients would not buy a show with Berlin in the title. Strolling along the beach one day, Joe Mastaroff, who was writing the musical's book, thought of two recent hits, Carnival and Camelot. Both started with a C and had three syllables. Why not call the show Cabaret? To play the MC, Prince tapped his friend Joel Grey. A nightclub headliner, Grey could not break into Broadway. The theater was very high-minded, he once said. When Prince called him, he was playing a pirate in a third-rate musical in New York's Jones Beach. "Hal knew I was dying," Grey recounts over lunch in the West Village, where he lives. "I wanted to quit the business." At first, he struggled to create the MC, who did not interact with the other characters. "He had numbers, but no words, no lines, no role," Grey wrote in his memoir, Master of Ceremonies. A polished performer, he had no trouble with the songs, the dances, the antics. But something was missing, he says. Then he remembered a cheap comedian he'd once seen in St. Louis. The comic had told lecherous jokes, gay jokes, sexist jokes, anything to get a laugh. One day in rehearsal, Grey did everything the comedian had done to get the audience crazy. "I was all over the girls, squeezing their breasts, touching their bottoms. They were furious. I was horrible. When it was over, I thought, this is the end of my career." He disappeared backstage and cried. And then from out of the darkness came Mr. Prince, Grey says. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Jolie, that's it." Cabaret played its first performance at the Schubert Theater in Boston in the fall of 1966. Grey stopped the show with the opening number, Willkommen. The audience wouldn't stop applauding, Grey recalls. "I turned to the stage manager and said, should I get changed for the next scene?" The musical ran long. It was in three acts, but it got a prolonged standing ovation. As the curtain came down, Richard Seff, an agent who represented Kander and Ebb, ran into Ebb in the aisle. "It's wonderful," Seff said. "You'll fix the obvious flaws." In the middle of the night, Seff's phone rang. It was Ebb. "You hated it," the songwriter screamed. "You are of no help at all." Ebb was reeling because he'd learned Prince was going to cut the show down to two acts. Ebb collapsed in his hotel bed, Kander holding one hand, Grey the other. "You're not dying, Fred," Kander told him. "Hal has not wrecked our show." Cabaret came roaring into New York, fueled by tremendous word of mouth. But there was a problem. Some Jewish groups were furious about If You Could See Her. How could you equate a gorilla with a Jew, they wanted to know, missing the point entirely. They threatened to boycott the show. Prince, his eye on ticket sales, told Ebb to change the line, "She wouldn't look Jewish at all," to something less offensive, "She isn't a Miskite at all," using the Yiddish word for a homely person. It is difficult to imagine the impact Cabaret had on audiences in 1966. World War II had ended only 21 years before. Many New York theatergoers had fled Europe or fought the Nazis. There were Holocaust survivors in the audience. There were people whose relatives had died in the gas chambers. Grey knew the show's power. Some nights, dancing with the gorilla, he'd whisper Jewish instead of Miskite. The audience gasped. Cabaret won 8 Tony Awards in 1967, catapulted Grey to Broadway stardom, and ran for 3 years. Seff sold the movie rights for $1.5 million, a record at the time. Prince, about to begin rehearsals for Stephen Sondheim's company, was unavailable to direct the movie, scheduled for a 1972 release. So the producers hired the director and choreographer Bob Fosse, who needed the job because his previous movie, Sweet Charity, had been a bust. Fossey, who saw Prince as a rival, stamped out much of what Prince had done, including Joel Grey. He wanted Ruth Gordon to play the MC, but Grey was a sensation, and the studio wanted him. "It's either me or Joel," Fossey said. When the studio opted for Grey, Fossey backed down, but he resented Grey, and relations between them were icy. A 26-year-old Liza Minnelli, on the way to stardom herself, was cast as Sally Bowles. The handsome Michael York would play the Cliff character, whose name in the movie was changed to Brian Roberts. And supermodel Marisa Berenson, who at the time seemed to be on the cover of Vogue every other month, got the role of a Jewish department store heiress, a character Fossey took from Isherwood's short story The Landowers. Cabaret was shot on location in Munich and Berlin. The atmosphere was extremely heavy, Berenson recalls. There was the whole Nazi period, and I felt very much the Berlin Wall, that darkness, that fear, all that repression. She adored Fossey, but he kept her off balance. She was playing a young woman traumatized by what was happening around her. "He was whispering obscene things in my ear. He was shaking me up." Minnelli, costumed by Halston for the film, found Fossey brilliant and incredibly intense, she tells Vanity Fair in a rare interview. "He used every part of me, including my scoliosis. One of my great lessons in working with Fossey was never to think that whatever he was asking couldn't be done. If he said do it, you had to figure out how to do it. You didn't think about how much it hurt. You just made it happen." Back in New York, Fossey arranged a private screening of Cabaret for Kander and Ebb. When it was over, they said nothing. "We really hated it," Kander admits. Then they went to the opening at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York. The audience loved it. "We realized it was a masterpiece," Kander says, laughing. "It just wasn't our show." The success of the movie, with its 8 Academy Awards, soon overshadowed the musical. When people thought of Cabaret, they thought of fingersnaps and bowler hats. They thought of Fossey, and of course Minnelli, who would adopt the lyric "Life is a Cabaret" as her signature. Her Best Actress Oscar became part of a dynasty. Her mother, Judy Garland, and father, director Vincente Minnelli, each had one of their own. "Papa was even more excited about the Oscar than I was," she says, "and baby, I was. No, I am still excited." By 1987, in part to burnish Cabaret's theatrical legacy, Prince decided to recreate his original production on Broadway, with Grey once again serving as the MC. But it had the odor of mothballs. The New York Times drama critic Frank Rich wrote that it was not, as Sally Bowles sings, perfectly marvelous, but it does approach the perfectly mediocre. Much of the show, he added, was old-fashioned and plodding. In the early 1990s, Sam Mendes, then a young director running a pocket-sized theater in London called the Dunmore Warehouse, heard the novelist Martin Amis give a talk. Amis was writing Time's Arrow about a German doctor who works in a concentration camp. "I've already written about the Nazis, and people say to me, 'Why are you doing it again?'" Amis said, "and I say, 'What else is there?'" "At the end of the day," Mendes tells me, "the biggest question of the 20th century is, how could this have happened?" Mendes decided to stage Cabaret at the Dunmore in 1993. Another horror was unfolding at the time. Serb paramilitaries were slaughtering Bosnian Muslims, ethnic cleansing on an unimaginable scale. Mendes hit on a terrific concept for his production. He transformed his theater into a nightclub. The audience sat at little tables with red lamps, and the performers were truly seedy. He told the actors playing the Kit Kat Club girls not to shave their armpits or their legs. "Unshaved armpits. It sent shockwaves around the theater," he recalls. Since there was no room, or money, for an orchestra, the actors played the instruments. Some of them could hit the right notes. To play the MC, Mendes cast Alan Cumming, a young Scottish actor whose comedy act Mendes had enjoyed. Can you sing? Mendes asked him. Yeah, Cummings said. Mendes threw ideas at him, and he was open to everything. Just before the first preview, Mendes suggested he come out during the intermission and chat up the audience, maybe dance with a woman. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.